history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some stories to tell, and you'll be amazed if you just take the time to ask and listen. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to hear from a World War II veteran today who will be 93 at the end of July. And for almost all of those 93 years, he's been in the wonderful city of Clovis, California, a city that really loves its veterans and takes care of them. And I'm just wondering, 93 years, and you came here to Clovis when you were just a little guy. Your father brought you from Oklahoma. What's the biggest difference from Clovis in 2016 compared to the 1920s when you got here?
Well, there was 900 people in Clovis, and gas was 12 cents a gallon, and we could buy an old Model T for $35, and now it's over 100,000.
Yeah, and you guys had a Model T.
Yeah.
Did you have to crank it up?
Yeah, I had to crank it. No starter.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Touring. Didn't have a door on the driver's side. It was a three-door.
Mm-hmm.
Because you crawl over to drive.
Right. Most of the people that are living in Clovis now, it's a lot bigger than 900 people. It's over 100,000 people in 2016. And most of them weren't alive during the Great Depression. What do you remember about those years, and what were the biggest challenges you faced?
Well, me, I had to quit school because my dad just couldn't afford us. There was five of us. So me and my dad and brother went over to Raisin City, and we set grapes out, mm-hmm. planted grapes, and we got 15 cents an hour apiece. The three of us made 45 cents an hour, and we was glad to get it because there wasn't any work. It was the only work there was farm work. I drove a tractor when I was 12 years old, plowing cotton and that kind of stuff.
And when you say you quit school, you quit after the eighth grade. From kindergarten to eighth grade, you went to school right on the same piece of land where you live now in Clovis, but you quit at the eighth grade because the family needed everybody to work.
Yeah, right.
And I imagine for folks who don't know this part of Central California, maybe they don't know how far that is, but Clovis to Raisin City, that was probably quite a haul in an old Model T.
Yeah, well, gas was 9 cents a gallon. an old Model T got good gas mileage.
Uh-huh.
So we could go over there and back on half a gallon or so.
Uh-huh.
There just wasn't any work at all. And just farm labor. We picked up figs at that time of the year. We cut grapes and we picked cotton.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and brother and I were food tramps at one time. We went to Lodi and picked cherries and Patterson and picked apricots.
Uh-huh.
And left my mother and the younger ones here.
So you would go wherever there was a crop to be harvested?
Yeah.
So you could make money?
Yeah. We picked cherries for 7 cents a gallon. So you can imagine how much money we made. But at that time, everybody was poor. My dad finally got a foreman job on a ranch on Shaw between Maple and Cedar. His boss farmed all that land. My dad got to be the foreman. And we had Zola Pendergrass, Betty Pendergrass, all the doctor's kids working out there too.
Uh-huh.
We worked in a cutting shed. One of us kids would get sick, and my doctor would come to the house, and my mother didn't have any money, so she'd give him a chicken.
Uh-huh.
And that was the pay.
Yeah, times were different.
Yeah.
Well, if there's any other memories of that time, feel free to share, but I guess I'll kind of jump you forward to 1941. You would have been 18 years old, huh?
Yeah,
December 7th, you remember?
Oh, yeah, very well. Me and my buddy and our girlfriends were sitting at a hot dog stand in Fresno. I forget the name of it, but it was a well-known hot dog stand, and it was cheap. We could afford 10 cents a hamburger or something. But at 11 o'clock, that's when we heard about it. So we come home, and me and my two buddies joined the Army. We went out here to the recruiting place, and they told us if we would recruit and join the Army, we would get to stay together. So we did get to stay together until we got to Monterey, the Paseo de Monterey, and I never seen him again until after the war was over. We got on a troop train in Monterey and went the southern route, and one of them got off in Texas, and the other one got off in Arizona, and they sent me all the way to Camp Stuart, Georgia.
Ooh, that's a long way from Clovis. Yeah.
And those old Georgia people didn't like soldiers at Savannah because the soldiers would mess with their daughters and the lawns. And So there was a big sign on the lawns, "Soldiers and dogs keep off the lawn."
Soldiers and dogs are in good company. Yeah. You know, a couple other questions come to mind. I don't want to jump around too much with you. But during those years, when you're a kid and you quit school after eighth grade because you need to work, and you're working whatever agricultural field you can find to make a few cents. Do you remember having any dreams or ambitions or thoughts of, you know, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
Well, I worked hard, and I knew I didn't want to be a poor guy like my dad and mother were. I'm just sorry I couldn't have helped them more. I wish I had it to do over. I'd help them. But I got out in 46. 47, I got married. And we weren't going to have any kids for 5 years till we kind of got on our feet. And we had two the first 5 years. I found out where they were coming from, so I got that taken care of. But when I got discharged at Camp Beale, I come home on the train. And my three buddies got out before I did. And they were waiting at the train, and they said, "You're going to go to work tomorrow." And I said, "What am I going to do?" And they says, "You're going to be a carpenter." And they were moving the barracks from Hammer Field. They were tearing them apart and putting them up where the park is now, right here at Sierra and Clovis Avenue, for the veterans to live in. And so I bought me a pair of overalls and a hammer and a saw, and that's where I went to work. I told them I wanted to draw my 5220. You know what that is. You get
$20 a week for 52 weeks.
But they said, "No, you're going to work." So I was fine. I went to work, and I really enjoyed it. And I've been a carpenter ever since. I built a lot of houses around Clovis. I didn't do any commercial, just houses.
So let's go back. You mentioned finding out about Pearl Harbor while you're at the hot dog stand on that Sunday morning. Was that a big deal? Did that get a reaction from you?
Well, yes, it did. I'm not bragging, but I wanted to join the Army, and I wanted to go overseas. I really trained hard, and I drove for the battery commander for a while. And I told him, "I want to go overseas. I don't want to fool around." And so, young and foolish, so when we got out of basic training, we got on a ship, and it was an old ship that was captured in World War II, Williams and Mary. It was made for 1,000 people, and there was 3,000 of us on it. So we stood in line for everything we did. I was down in the engine room floor, and hotter than a son of a gun. And it was about four floors down. The hammocks were about 11 inches apart. And when you got in one, you didn't turn over. You just had to lay in that position.
Yeah.
So me and my buddy would wait till 12 o'clock at night, and then we'd go up and take our blanket and sleep by the smokestack. It was nice and warm. We'd get in there and hide, and that's where we would sleep. So the seagulls, they were with us all the way. Because when we left, we seen one with his leg off. And he just had one leg. And when we got overseas, he was still with us. But the ship would throw out a lot of stuff. And the waste from the toilet. And the toilet was a 12-inch pipe about that big.
Yeah.
And they had a stool welded on every 36 inches. And there was probably 10. You had to stand in line to use it. And the ocean water comes up through there, pumps it all of that, you don't flush it or anything, the water.
Yeah.
And so one day a wise guy got an idea, and he, at the head of the pipe, he lit a newspaper and let it go down through there. And everybody jumped up, hair was all burnt off. So
wise
we got
guys,
to England,
right. Yeah.
And we took amphibious training. And that's going up and down a rope ladder on a ship and all that stuff. That's what we did. And then June the 6th, 1944, we got on the ship at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we headed across the English Channel to Normandy. And we got there and all hell broke loose. We were getting out of the, onto the landing barges. And they couldn't get up to the shore, because Hitler had drove iron stakes in the ground out about 8 or 10 feet. And so we had to, we couldn't get out on the sand. We had to jump out with a 90-pound pack and a rifle. And a lot of the kids couldn't make it. I was a good swimmer, and I was young and been on the farm and strong. And so I made it. And going up there, I got something right here in this leg. And so they took me to the ship hospital and just... the medics took care of it and put me back in the field, back on. And so that was one time the medic took care of it, no doctor. They were taking care of the ones that really needed them.
I think everybody hears you describe those things. You lived them, and maybe it's not that big a deal to you, so you tell it very matter-of-factly, but there are some pretty intense situations that you were in. You've been training in England. Yeah. You said they got you up at 3 in the morning on June 6th to head across the channel, but... did you know that was coming? Had you had a sense or an indication?
We didn't know where we were going.
But you knew something was going to happen.
Yeah.
What kind of weapons were you supposed to use?
Then I just, my machine gun was on the way over, you know, in case we got there. I just had an M1 rifle.
So as you're getting off the ship.
We just had an M1 rifle.
An M1 rifle, and you said a 90-pound pack.
Yeah.
But they can't get you to the beach.
No.
You got to do some swimming to get there.
Right.
With 90 pounds on your back.
And a rifle.
And a rifle. And you're seeing some of the other guys sinking below the surface.
Yeah, they already got killed.
You, before you even reached the beach, some of your buddies drowned.
They didn't make it. They drowned, yeah.
And you're soaking this in as a 21-year-old kid with bullets flying and artillery going off and planes overhead and all kinds of craziness. What was going through your mind in those moments?
Well, I was scared.
I would have been.
And I thought, boy, I wish they'd shoot me, get it over with.
Really?
You know, because everybody was getting shot and getting hurt. The only thing that saved me, I guess, they took me out to the ship and worked on my leg. But it was a horrible life, you know, a horrible thing to see those young guys getting killed. And as I was crawling up the beach, I would hide behind some of the dead ones. You know, I just crawled, and I'd get their rifle and their guns, I mean their ammunition, because I'd run out of ammunition.
I know I'm going back and forth, but another question that strikes me. Before you got there, when they get you up at 3 in the morning and you've got this journey across the channel and you don't know what to expect, during those hours, were there some thoughts going through your mind? Did you think, I might not see tomorrow?
Yeah.
So what do you do with that? Do you just close your eyes and grit your teeth?
Yeah,
do you say a prayer? Do you talk to your buddies?
Yeah.
What do you do?
You think, well, I'm awful young to die,
yeah,
but I'm probably going to. And, you know, if it hadn't been for a bunch of us old poor roughneck boys, it might have been different. But most of the guys around here that went in service were just farm boys and old hard-working guys with muscles, you know, and that's what saved my life. I was poor all my life, and I knew how to take care of myself.
Mm. But then you're hitting this beach, and as you said, guys are dying around you. The bullets are flying. If you have to take these other rifles from the dead, it means you've been firing your gun at the enemy and running out of ammunition, hiding behind dead bodies. They've called that day the longest day. Is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And explain to us how you got hurt, because you said that injury at that point maybe saved your life.
I don't know if it was a grenade or what, but it just tore my leg up right there, and the medics just sewed it up. They could take care of it. And then another time, see this, I got a scar right across there.
Let me ask you about that in a bit, because I want to stay on the 6th. So you get some kind of shrapnel from something, whether it's a shell, a grenade, or whatever, in the back of your left calf.
Yeah.
That makes it really hard to walk.
Yeah.
So they get you off the beach, medics got you, and get you back to your ship. How long do you think you were back on the ship before you went back to the shore?
I was probably less than a day, because they sewed it up and wrapped it up real good and told me to get going.
But in those hours, whether that's 12 hours or 24 hours, thousands died.
Yeah.
You would have been, very likely could have been
one of them, yeah.
So getting hurt saved your life.
Probably saved my life.
But then you're going right back into it.
Yeah.
And you probably didn't feel that great. It had to be some pain you're dealing with.
Yeah, well, I was young and tough, and they did a good job sewing it up and wrapping it up. You know, the medics were, the sergeant was a good friend of mine, and he took good care of me.
Was there a point in those next couple days where you came to grasp the magnitude of what happened there, or how extreme the casualties were?
Yeah, but we were gone. As soon as we got the lead wave, we could get out of there. Well, we got out of there. But what I didn't tell you is that Churchill and Eisenhower had already planned to bomb the up above, you know, where the Germans were.
Right.
Bomb all the gun positions.
Right.
But it was foggy, and the planes couldn't take off. You know, those old planes then, they didn't have all this radar stuff. And so we were just setting ducks. If they could have got there and bombed those, it would have been a much easier deal to take the beach. But see, Hitler knew that we were going to land there weeks ahead of time. He had set up all the gun positions, and he was shooting at the ships. And ships had big guns, and they were shooting at the gun positions too.
Right.
Up above.
You can still find some craters up on those cliffs today from the American ships that were shelling them. You mentioned seeing guys die around you. Did you lose some guys that you knew pretty well that day?
Yeah. Some of my buddies that I trained with.
As a 21-year-old, how did you deal with that? Here are these guys that you've gotten to know all through training and that...
Well, you just have to take it with a grain of salt and go on. Do your job.
Mm. And you were able to do that already at that point?
I figured I'd be next.
You know? And they're buried there at Normandy?
Yeah.
Have you ever been back?
No, I've never been back there. A couple of times they've took the bunch of soldiers back there, but I never got on that drill. I'd like to get on it, but it's hard for me to get around.
That's the reality at nearly 93 years old. It may be tough to get around, but he's more than able to take us back in time and share his memories from World War II. Right now, it's time for our first break, but when we come back, more about the injuries Ray suffered during the war and the issues he still deals with today because of the conditions he faced during the Battle of the Bulge. You can see what this tall farm boy looked like during World War II and the way he looks now if you check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.